CataractCoach.com, podcast series, episode number 173, with Dr. Minas Coroneo, inspiring ophthalmic innovations and driving that curiosity that caused him to invent Tri-Pan Blue Dye and so much more.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest. If you do anterior segment surgery, you should be thankful to this man every single week that you operate. If you ever used Tri-Pan Blue Dye, if you ever done MIGS, if you've ever thought about why do we get cortical cataracts in this direction or why do we get pterygia, this is the one man who has solved these mysteries for you, and that is Professor and Chairman Dr. Minas Coroneo. Welcome to our podcast, my friend.
Thank you, Uday. Great honor, and I look forward to actually meeting you online, as it were.
So you have done such amazing things. Now, you're probably best known for the idea of Tri-Pan Blue Dye. And for the younger ophthalmologists may not realize, back when I trained in like the 1990s, a white cataract was so scary because there was zero visualization.
Indeed.
Right?
Very scary. And how this happened was that I succeeded Professor Fred Hollows, who was the chairman of the department ahead of me. And he became famous for working with Indigenous Australians and then in Third World eye care. And he did a survey of Australia looking at trachoma back in the 70s. It was a huge undertaking. And when that finished, he then set up a clinic in a place called Bourke, which is in the middle of nowhere. How you get there is you drive northwest from Sydney for 10 hours and eventually you'll hit it. And so it's a lovely community. And so he passed away and I became chairman. And there were about 100 people in the region blind with cataract who couldn't come to Sydney. So we flew a team up, the companies helped, we had a phaco machine, we had a microscope, all of these things. By the time we got there, the first operating list, 20 patients, half of them were white cataract.
Wow.
And you're sitting there in the middle of nowhere and trying to, and so that's a kind of a life-changing event. So it takes 10 hours to drive back to Sydney. And I kept thinking to myself, how do I fix this? Now, part of my background is that I'm a failed physiologist. I was very interested in membrane transport. I went to some inspirational lectures as an undergrad. I worked in a renal laboratory, how do molecules get across cells and all of this. And part of that research, I was operating on rat salivary glands and pancreas and so on. So I learnt my microsurgery as a second year medical student. And part of the surgery involved delineating tissue for which you use dyes.
Okay.
So that was my first introduction to dyes. So in our department, we were then near an industrial area and we had a book, a Toxicology of the Eye. And I remember seeing somewhere in there dyes under D. So you ran your finger down. So I drove 10 hours back, went to my office, found this book, ran my finger down, found that Tri-Pan Blue had been used in the anterior segment of the human eye by Professor Norn in Scandinavia years before. Wow. And they were using it as a vital dye to look at damage to the endothelium. And then it was intracapsular surgery, and he noticed coincidentally that the dye stained the capsule of the lens that he was removing.
Oh.
So I couldn't believe my luck. So I used the same concentration I got from the eye bank. I used some pig eyes, some eye bank eyes, did a small clinical study. And back then I was fairly naive about these things, but I wrote a patent. I was introduced to a patent lawyer, and I wasn't the first to publish on this, so hardly anyone knows that I had anything to do with it. But I got the first US patent. And the rest was fairly straightforward. And I realized that it wasn't just for staining the capsule of the lens. Tri-Pan Blue stains basement membranes. So right. The original patent had staining of internal limiting membrane, everything I could think of, including it stains the trabecular meshwork. So if you're trying to find it in glaucoma surgery, all of this was in the original patent. And so back then, the US Patent Office asked me to send them my notes of when the discovery actually happened. And I had a letter from me to the pharmacy of my hospital asking them to make up the dye. I think that was proof of the exact date of when all this happened. So that was Trypan Blue. And of course, it was successful, and it meant that I could then use income from that to fund other projects. I mean, if you're an academic and you're sitting there applying for grants year in, year out. And so I was a little bit game, and I, whenever I had a bright idea, wrote a patent. I have about 60. Now,
I found 30 of the patents online, but obviously you have much more. You have 60, you've doubled that.
Yeah, that depends. They're families and so on. But I commercialized that one. And the other big one is I have the core patents for the CyPass.
For MIGS. Yes. You basically started the whole field that we now.
I didn't start it. I think the people with the iStent were a year or two ahead of me. But I had the idea of suprachoroidal drainage because as a first-year resident, I had a patient who had trauma and a cyclodialysis, and the pressure dropped to zero. And no matter what we did back then, we couldn't get the pressure up. I'm thinking to myself, hey, how do we control this? Now, again, I wasn't the first person to do this. Somewhere in the 1890s, a very clever German professor did a similar sort of thing. But right at that time, if you remember, there was an intraocular lens which would fit through would fold up into a 1 millimeter cylinder.
The old thin optics.
Thin optics, yes. So I saw that, and in my training, I'd met Tony Maltino in New Zealand, and he had, a plate with a tube, and everyone saw a thin optic, and I saw a plate for a stent that would fit in the suprachoroidal space.
Smart.
So you do what you can to move things forward. So I put one of these into a pig eye and perfused it and did all this stuff. And again, same patent attorney. And we got this through. And I'm sitting at the Hawaiian Eye meeting one year, and the people from Transcend approached me, and they had IP in different versions and so on. But these patents were the core for that invention. And so I helped to design the original stent because obviously it doesn't have a plate on it. It's a tube with holes. And I argued with their biomedical engineer for some years about how this should evolve and so on and so forth. And it was quite fun. It's with some inventions, you have the eureka moment, but with others, you have to sort of play with them a little bit. And the greatest compliment that was ever paid to me was from this biomedical engineer who said to me, "You think like an engineer."
Yeah.
That was for him a great compliment.
Well, it's funny you said that because I've been working now with a lot of engineers for the robotic cataracts, our new project.
Yeah.
Listen, ophthalmologists are smart, but engineers are another level of smart. Oh my gosh. These people are, I don't have the brains to be an engineer. I just don't.
Well, I think, look, we're lucky to be in the profession that we're in. And I think you adapt yourself to the circumstances in which you find yourself. And I mean, ophthalmology has always attracted very bright people. The stakes are very high. I mean, human vision from way back, it was an important thing. And our relationship with the rest of medicine is interesting as well, because we've always been, in the English system, a minor surgical specialty. And pretty much we're taken for granted and so on. In Europe, it's different. And all because in Austria, the emperor's wife had a servant who lost her sight, and they had to bring someone in from Paris. So the emperor created the first chair of ophthalmology in Vienna. It had the equivalent status of the chairs of medicine and surgery. And if you go across the German-speaking countries, the eye departments are huge.
Yes.
So they have had a head start. And whereas the English system, it was sort of like, we'll have an eye hospital over here and we'll have a foot hospital over here and so on. And it really didn't join mainstream medicine. And to this day in the British speaking places, we still have eye hospitals which are separated from the rest of medicine. And I mean, I think those barriers have broken down. And in this era, you have to understand that the eye is connected to the rest of the body.
Oh, no, for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, I did a little homework ahead of time. And first I realized that you not only have your MBBS, like all ophthalmologists would have in Australia, but you also have a Master of Science, a Master of Surgery, a Doctor of Medicine. You also did, You did some training in Germany in Würzburg. You also were in Boston at Mass Eye and Ear in the Howe Lab. You've done the whole world.
Well, I'm a little unusual in that I'd set out. I went. You're lucky with mentors, so I've had some fabulous people to follow. As an introduction week in medicine in 1972, I went to a lecture about medical research. I emerged from the lecture theatre and I said, I am going to do research. And I was very interested in basic research because, you know, we sit in a dark room all day looking at these conditions which we can't fix.
Right.
I have one slide which says, I hate glaucoma. Okay. It's kind of... And the reason we can't fix them is we actually don't understand what's going on.
Right.
There's a famous roboticist who worked at MIT. He came from Australia, Rodney Brooks, and he has a book about robots. And in the book he says, well, if you encounter a problem you can't solve, you round up all the conventional wisdom and throw it out and start again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've done that a few times, and the first thing that happens is it makes you unpopular. Because you threaten the foundations of the knowledge of people that are, you know, your contemporaries. And how dare you? How dare you have the arrogance to challenge the status quo?
Right.
So you go to those meetings and everyone goes on about innovation and so on and so forth. They don't mostly mean it. What they mean is that they want something that they can probably market to make loot and so on and so forth. But if you challenge the underlying concepts of any particular area, you're in big trouble. So I've had lots of fun. I'm currently rewriting a paper for one of the journals where there are two referees and one just simply didn't get it at all. I mean, it's just – so those are the frustrations of academia and trying to do these
things. That's the problem, though, with current ideas of peer review. So I'll give you a simple example. So in terms of peer review, we submitted a group I work with ideas for an article we wanted to submit for one of the journals. The peer review were three ophthalmologists who had clear financial interests against us.
They rejected
everything. By the way, we got a patent for that idea and sold a patent this year for like a crazy amount.
Yeah.
And just to think, 10 years earlier, they said, no, it's a stupid idea, get lost.
Oh, Uday, it happens not infrequently. And the ultimate revenge where you fail to publish something is to have a patent.
sell the patent.
Yeah. Oh, yes, that's even better, of course. I've been around that dog track a few times, and so I know. And the interesting thing is things go on. So. With the CyPass, a very interesting story, and we've published a little bit of this lately. I predicted in 2008 that there would be endothelial cell loss years later.
Okay.
Why? Everyone thought that it was mechanical, the stent pushing on the endothelium and so on. But if you think about it, the cornea is avascular. It requires aqueous humor for its nutrition. And we have 360 degrees of angle, which allow you during the day to have convection currents. So you have aqueous circulating because the cornea is 2 degrees cooler than the iris. So daytime, you have this very nice circulation. At night, 25% of our sleep is rapid eye movement sleep. So you have a shaking effect. So the aqueous gets circulated a little bit at night. Now, you put a single exit point in the eye for aqueous to flow out. It disrupts these currents.
All
rushes out through one opening.
Yeah.
So 180 degrees away from the opening, you have stagnation. Now, when von Graefe invented the first glaucoma procedure, you were hard-pressed to get any relief. If you didn't lower the pressure, the patient lost their sight. They'd be in peel. So any hole in the eye that drained fluid, fantastic. And back then, the average age of a German was only about 30 years. So it didn't matter. They weren't going to live to 90. Now, all these years later, we're still living with that because it's still hard work. The eye evolved so that it would scar down. If you're an animal in the wild and you slash your eye on a branch, better to have some sight than none. So all these scarring mechanisms come into play. And so we've really been up against it. And so that's another reason why I went for suprachoroidal. It was an internal drainage. So then we put all of this into a computer model. And the way you get maintenance of some form of circulation is you need a minimum of 4 stents. Now, I said this in 2008, and we're 2026, and I've had a very difficult time convincing anybody that the truth of this matter or not, but it's a different approach. So it's got very little to do with the material in the stent and how far it sticks out and the rest of it.
It's the current. Right.
And you know, we're all sensible people. If you sit back and look at this, well, how stupid. I mean, you know, and how you thought one would think that you'd get away with a single hole exit point for glaucoma surgery is nuts. So I've had my little sort of intellectual battles with this in the background. But on the commercial front, you know, companies are very reluctant to go down a path that isn't basically accepted by the majority of people, because then their concern is that they won't use it.
So I should have 4 stents then. So I should have 1, 2, 3, 4 stents per eye.
Yeah. Now, we don't know exactly whether there should be, we've published this as a computer model, whether there should be in each quadrant, because the collector channels are not uniformly distributed. Right? Mostly they're on the nasal side, which is convenient because if you're coming from temporal, you can put 3 eye stents in on this side. And so the next dye I've worked on is a dye that shows where the collector channels are. So you inject it into the eye, it goes through the trabecular meshwork, through the canal of Schlemm, and out in the collector channels. So I've been working on this for the last 10 years or so. It's taken forever.
Is that your indigo carmine?
Yes, indigo.
And I can see it. Yeah.
So, one thing leads to another, leads to another. So it's not like I've had one invention and stopped still. It's an evolving thing.
Clearly, but it's funny, the more you discuss this, because these are topics that I think my audience will find very fascinating, because this is never discussed.
Yeah. So that was one preoccupation for a decade or so. and then the thing that I'm probably proudest of was the business to do with light focusing and the whole idea of how the eye is exposed to light. And so
the Coronet effect.
Yes. Well, we so cool.
I learned about this 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But it's not distributed enough to the general ophthalmologist.
Well, it's published. I don't quite know how these things get ignored. And I mean, no one, one group have told me that I'm wrong about it. There was a paper in Investigative Ophthalmology about 5 years ago where they redid the computer modeling. And we've recently repeated it, and I'm about to show that they're wrong. So humans have a wide temporal field of vision, great for survival, but it acts as a collecting zone for ultraviolet light when you go out, and it hits the temporal limbus and is focused onto the nasal limbus and the nasal aspect of the lens and intraocular lenses, because it also accounts for dysphotopsia. Mm-hmm. So what happened was this Fred Hollows, when you're training people, and we've just interviewed for a new professor of ophthalmology, and we asked about how you deal with your students and so on. And I was thinking about this, what happened to me. So the first thing is that your mentor should challenge you.
Right.
So Hollows would say to all of his residents, tell me something I don't know. Now, he knew everything because he'd read everything. He used to walk around with a lancet in his pocket. Tell me something I don't know. And what he meant was something new. So he was also fairly casually dressed, and I went to work for him, and one morning I'm putting on my tie, and he, of course, never wore ties. And I'm looking at the mirror, putting on my tie, and I could see this spot of light on my nasal limbus, and it had come from a window behind me. Okay. And right at that time, I'd been studying optics, and I saw my first pterygium, and I, you know, one and one made two and so on. And I went to him, and I told him this, and he kind of stopped in mid-sentence, and he realized that it was significant. And, of course, I presented it at our first college meeting, and one of the senior people walked up to me and said, "Son, we don't believe you," and walked off. And I've got a tape recording of Hollows presenting this work somewhere with someone trying to shout him down and so on. All these years later, it was the basis of what we understand about pterygium location, and I linked in all the pathophysiology and so on and so forth. And the really exciting thing, we now have a thing that will fit in a smartphone, which shows you UV damage in children as young as 8.
Oh, wow.
So you can, they get a bit like when you get sunspots on your skin. You can, if you look at your skin in UV, you can see all these changes. So we've adopted this for the eye. It will fit in a smartphone. And it means that now, instead of telling kids to go out and wear sunglasses and a hat because they're going to ignore you, they can do eye selfies.
All right.
And they can see this spot and it might grow. And they might think to themselves, oh.
So we have a lot of young ophthalmologists in our podcast. Young, like beginning residents, beginning of the career. So basically the bottom line is that you can now use what you're saying, basically it's conjunctival ultraviolet autofluorescence. You can see that these temporal light rays are really delivering a lot more UV energy to the nasal aspect. This is why you get a nasal pterygium. It's why cortical cataracts are much more common nasally. It makes a ton of sense.
So, you know, there I am sitting there as a first, so I'm saying to your residents, as a first year resident, look for something that has been missed.
Right.
You know, which is what I did, pretty much. So the first thing is challenge your residents. And the second thing is somehow or other try to inspire them. I mean, you know, the thing is we all try and get through our exams and qualify and everything else, but aim for the sky.
Right.
I mean, you've got one last time, okay, and you can sit there and do all of this stuff, but try and make a difference. Because when you do, I mean, at one point in my life, I'm sitting there and Tri-Pan was being sold around the world. They were selling 4 million bottles a year. So we get taught to teach to treat a few thousand patients and so on and so forth. But you can go way beyond that if you invent something that is useful.
Well, I think 100% of cataract surgeons use Tri-Pan blue dye on a regular basis the entirety of their careers.
Well, I use it on every case.
Wow.
And my logic, and I can, of course, I can do that. But my logic in this is that it's taking off an airplane into a clear blue sky. You can't see the next storm.
You're right.
So you get to a point in the cataract where everything looks fine, and then something happens. But you can now still see the capsule.
But young people, young ophthalmologists, if you're under age 40, you don't realize what a big deal this was. Because when I was a resident in the late 1990s, I had a professor using rose Bengal to stain the anterior lens capsule. And you know what happened? It killed the corneal endothelial cells.
Yeah.
You had a white cataract. You had a cataract where you looked beautiful. And then you had a corneal transplant.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. And most people don't understand this. The history of Tri-Pan. So in the early 1900s, Germany had colonies in Africa.
Okay.
And the cattle and the humans got sleeping sickness.
Okay.
Sleeping sickness was caused by the trypanosome.
Oh.
So they had dyes because they had invented them for clothing and so on. And some of these dyes were then used in histology. And so they started using this dye, looking at it as a cure for sleeping sickness. That was where the thing came from. Now,
interesting.
When you look at the chemistry of all of this, there are acidic dyes and basic dyes, and one lot is safer than the other. And again, in my background research before, you know, when you file a patent and have to pay for it yourself, you are very cautious about what you put in it. Yeah. And so at the time, all of the chemistry of this, and also it had been used in the eye to look at endothelial cells. So we knew that it wasn't going to be endothelial toxic. And then, of course, the competition came along and claimed that it made the capsule brittle and everything else. And, of course, all of that was shown to be complete nonsense. It was based on one case by one opinion leader.
Yeah.
And they repeated it and so on. It is incredibly safe. And I actually like the capsule being stiffer. And for a white cataract, what I do, and as a tip, is I put it in the anterior chamber for 1 minute.
Oh, for a whole minute?
Hang on. Flush it out and put it in again for another minute.
Oh, wow. Then it's really blue.
It is really blue, but it's also stiff.
Ah.
And so then you...
So it won't run out.
But it doesn't. It can, of course, and this is not. And so there are other aspects to Argentinian flag, which in due course I'll tell you about, because we've been working on this as well. So all of this has been, for me, tremendous fun. And of course, I had access to Tri-Ban about 5 years before it came on the market.
Sure.
Which I went for several years without breaking a capsule. It was fantastic. It was a great time in my life. So
what are your best pearls? Because every ophthalmologist listens to our podcast, and this is the top podcast in all of ophthalmology. We'll literally get 10,000 ophthalmologists in the podcast, this podcast. Yeah. So what are your best pearls for these white cataracts, intumescent white cataracts, for a young surgeon who's just learning this?
The most important thing is to only use phenylephrine to dilate the pupil.
Oh, why is that? Now you're teaching me.
Well, and I presented this at Pearl Jam, you know, at Ascaris and the Academy. We have a session called Pearl Jam. So if you use cycloplegics, some of the zonules insert at the lens equator. You know, they go over and under and so on and so forth. And I was thinking about this, and everyone thinks that we get at Argentinian flag because it's like a balloon under pressure and you put a hole in it first. But if you look at the physics of balloons bursting, and people have done that, often the edges are ragged. It's not a split.
Mm.
So I started thinking to myself, what if the pressure inside the lens isn't high at all? All of us are taught to dilate the pupil maximally so you can get in there. But if you think about it, if the zonule is pulling on the periphery of the capsule, and it tears in a more or less straight line.
That's the pull.
Yes. So about 10 years ago, I stopped using cycloplegics, and I used topical phenylephrine, and I used phenylephrine in the anterior chamber. And if it's a white cataract, that's how we manage it.
I never even thought of this.
Well, yeah, but that's my job. Sorry. You see, this is basic.
Now that you say it, it makes sense because, on the videos where you pop a balloon, it's like ragged, but this is a straight line, so there's got to be some outward pulling force.
Yeah. So that's not to say there isn't pressure inside.
And I
just sent some of this off for publication. So that reduces the rate of Argentinian flag dramatically. And we've got a series we've sent in for publication. It'll take 10 years to get it published and so on. So that's my first tip. If you've got an Argentinian flag, and one of the case reports we've sent, I had a patient with bilateral white cataracts. There was no phenylephrine in the first eye, did it perfectly. In our hospital, someone ignored my written orders and put in the usual dilation regime, and that Argentinian flag. So that's N equals one in one patient, surgeon, and so on. And it doesn't mean very much necessarily, because a year had gone by, the second lens was a bit thicker, and so on. There could have been other factors. But nonetheless, it's a very simple thing to try, and my contribution to the Argentinian flag.
Well, here's the beauty. The new peer review today, I can put a video up for Cataract Coach and poll my audience. And with YouTube and Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn, all this combined, I can get 40,000 ophthalmologists to see the video in the first few days. And so we will get a big consensus immediately. In fact, after this podcast airs, which will be a Sunday coming up, you give me a video of any white cat, I'll put it up online. I'll put a poll for the audience, and my audience is all ophthalmologists. You'll see the answer immediately. You don't have to wait for the nonsense peer review of three, quote, professionals evaluating your paper. Nonsense.
Yeah. I think I'm a little bit old-fashioned in that when I went through university, the idea was that you would be in an ivory tower somewhere talking to other very smart people and so on. And, of course, the internet came along, and now you can talk to anyone. And I've been a participant. So I've been part of the CareNet group for like three decades. Mark Lewis has done a tremendous job with that, and I've just been working with him to write it up. And it's meant that I've met a whole bunch of really talented people, mostly in North America. And because of the time zone differences, if I say a difficult case, I post it. Next morning, I get up and there are 20 expert opinions. And so it's been tremendous for our patients, It's been tremendous for me because, if you're in a particular city, sure, we don't actually see our colleagues all that often because you're busy and doing what you're doing. But virtually now, you can reach almost anyone. And, of course, you've made this an art form because I always felt that it was better for me to spend time doing research and thinking about things rather than spending a lot of time. I don't prepare a whole lot of video presentations and so on. I mean, it's not my reason for being. I want to get behind all of this. And sure. So I very much appreciate what you do, and it's important for teaching and our residents and everyone else can look at it. And if you go down the road to the new Getty Museum in Los Angeles, I don't know if
you're here.
Well, as you leave, there is a bust of John Paul Getty with a little inscription at the bottom of it. And basically says that the purpose of the museum was to delight and educate. And you see, the two things go together.
Right.
If it's unpalatable, people are going to ignore it. So it has to be fun.
No, that's for sure. I mean, the beauty, what I've learned in ophthalmology now for the last 30 years is that we all have a slightly different role. And yeah. And the beauty is we don't have to have the same role. There is no way on this planet that I can have your brain and I will come up with 60 patents. I just can't. I don't have that. But what I have is a different skill set where I can analyze a video, I can talk about a video, I can distribute a video to people. So we all come with something a little bit different.
Yeah, and that's the fun of it. And it takes you a while to realize that.
Yeah.
None of this happens, at the beginning, of course.
So
the other big change, of course, is AI, which I don't want to get into in huge detail. And I was a skeptic because I watched Kubrick's 2001: A Space Odyssey, where Hal kills the crew of the spaceship. The reason that Hal did this is that he received conflicting advice from home base and from the captain of the ship.
Okay.
So the computer reasoned something wasn't right here, and probably humans were an inferior race anyway. So, wipe
yeah.
it out. But all of that said, it's quite amazing. It's made me much more efficient at what I do in synthesizing information. I don't use it to write papers.
Okay.
I use it to bounce ideas off. Now, this thing can read faster than me. So, for example, if I found a passage in a book and I've forgotten where it was, I will download the book into AI and ask it to find all the references to a particular idea. So, right. Like 2 seconds later, there it is. It can actually think faster than us in a sort of a logical way. I mean, it's not good at inventing things, but
right.
I've got a new theory around how pterygium forms. So we've spent 30 years looking at the head of the pterygium and how it invades into the cornea. But the real puzzle is the body and tail. So now you have inflammation at the head with inflammatory mediators going back to the nasal fornix, conjunctival fornix, tenons and the anterior orbit, where there are other populations of stem cells.
Okay.
So now you have inflammation not just in one site, but at least two others.
Sure.
And they form the blood vessels and the scar tissue and so on in the tail of the and body of the pterygium. And so that's why Laurie Hirst's perfect technique, he basically obliterates all of the tissue from which these other stem cells can come, which is my view. I have a particular view of that. Or Shepherd Seng would oversew the nasal aspect of the wound so that tenons didn't have access to the ocular surface. So looking at this, and I put this into ChatGPT and ask it, where else in the body are there stem cell interactions from different populations? And there are at least 5 other examples, mostly in the gut. Now, I wasn't smart enough to work it out because when I send this off for publication, I say, this is novel. How come this only happens in the eye? And, of course, it happens elsewhere. It's just right. that we're not used to looking for it.
I don't look at the gut.
Yeah, but before AI, I couldn't have done that easily. It would have taken me, if I ever worked it out, would have taken months to read all the papers and everything else. So it's just been magical for me. And, of course, the version I use will hallucinate, and you can pick it, because these processes are iterative. You tell it something and it'll come back. And when it goes off home base, I put in a line something like, oh, you're having your Monty Python moment, I see. And it takes it, you know, with good grace. It says, oh, yes, I have to admit, you know, it's almost like you have an English butler for the intellect, and you're kind of, you know, going backwards and forwards. So I'm looking forward to the next little while, because I've become much more productive than I ever was. And, you know, I'm at a point in my career where, you know, the university looks at me and thinks, well, you know, should you think about retiring? And I said, well, I'm actually more productive now than I ever was.
You're just getting started.
Yeah, well, and so I've been having fun with them as well. And so I'm tenured, so unless I do something outrageous, I should be fine.
The AI stuff's going to change everything. So I'm actually involved in a group called Advanced Euclidean Solutions. We had the first USA patent for using AI to improve IOL calculations. And we actually we sold that patent earlier this year in January to a big company. And so now we're working on multiple more patents in the same AI space, but we found it to be an absolute game changer.
Yeah. What I've done, just out of curiosity, I've said to it, can you do an algorithm of me as an inventor?
Okay.
So it said to me, stick in all your patents and papers, tell me where it succeeded, where it failed, why, and so on. Now, the critical thing in invention are the small decisions made about direction, which are based on your experience and, you know, insight and everything else. It can't do that part of it.
Okay.
But if it's the basic mechanism for how I go, like on the Tripan story, I went to this book and looked at dyes and so on. If it can do the basic part of it, then that can be trained.
Mm.
So currently working on that. So, I mean, I've tried to teach my residents what I do, and apart from doing ophthalmology, I have trained or mentored something like 17 people who are at associate professor level or higher, and you try and impart some wisdom, you know, this is how I did this and so on. And a few of them are really very good. I mean, they're going to leave me for dead in due course. But when I drop dead, or when anyone drops dead, you lose that knowledge. So right. AI, a mechanism by which you can pass on some of it.
Right.
Heaven forbid if I pass on my personality, that would be terrible. But you know, the dad jokes and so on. But the invention side of it, I think if that can be not so much automated, but if you had something where you've got a clinical problem or whatever, and you put this into this thing and say, how do you fix it? And you get a couple of suggestions you wouldn't have thought of. That might make a difference.
No, I think it's true. I think a mind that comes up with 60 patents or whatever, 100 patents, thinks differently and has a different kind of characteristic or attributes than like my mind. I can't come up with that. And so be able to bottle that and then use that in future applications is very magical.
Well, I should say, though, that, and again, for the residents, early in my career, that was a handicap. If you train in a surgical specialty, if you don't go from point A to point B,
yes, yeah,
something wrong with you.
You have to accept the dogma. You have to kiss the ring. You have to follow the straight and narrow path.
Yeah. Whereas my approach to life was to go by the most circuitous means.
Right.
I mean, you know, the princess of serendipity.
You'd always ask why. You would ask why. Why can't I make it better?
Yeah. Yeah. And typically, if you go from point A to point B, you miss it. That's the whole point of it. And so, and I've had a lot of fun going around in circuits all over the place until I eventually home in on what I'm focused on. And the other bit is that it's important to know not just ophthalmology. You need to know other things that you can borrow from. Yeah. And one of the problems with our current training is you get focused too early. So I did, you know, an intern year in Sydney. I did 2 years in a renal laboratory in Würzburg. So I learned a lot of internal medicine. I still scan through New England Journal most weeks and looking for stuff that's relevant to us. And this is the other thing, you spend your whole life studying science. There was a very famous Englishman, C.P. Snow, who wrote a book called about the two cultures, the arts and the sciences, as if they were two separate cities. But in fact, the interactions, and so over the years I've learned quite a bit about art. I started, so when you give lectures to 200 medical students, how you retain their attention is a problem. So I started looking for evidence of eye disease in artists that you could see in their works of art.
Oh, yeah. This is famous stuff. Please tell me more.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there are now books written on this subject, but I was doing this in the early 90s. And so I travel around the planet looking for... So colorblind artists have a particular palette. One of them had a blocked nasolacrimal system. So when he went outside, his eye would water and he couldn't see. So all of his painting, most of his paintings were painted from indoors and they're framed by window. So those sorts of things. And if I had one slide like that in my talk, I had their attention for maybe a microsecond. And so I got interested in art from that perspective and I started collecting art and so on. My family owned a cinema. So I grew up in an Art Deco cinema and I learned how to be a projectionist in my early teens, which is how I got interested in optics.
Ah, interesting. Oh, okay.
So then TV came along in the 1950s and killed the cinema business. But I still own my parents' cinema.
Oh, how interesting.
Been restoring it. And so, I've had all these different bits to, my life, which has made it quite a lot of fun. So anyway, now.
You also pay homage to your Greek heritage. I know you, I looked up online, you've got a clinic in Kythira.
Yeah, well, okay.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't continue it, of course, but what happened was that during the 2000 Olympics in Sydney, I left town because the government had raided the hospital budgets to pay for the Olympics. Of course, they disputed that, but my department came under threat.
Okay.
I bought a slit lamp, I put on an airplane, and I went to my father's village in Kythera and started a small clinic in, there was an old people's home. And there were about 60 people in it.
With this is an average, small island, basically, in the Ionic Sea, off the coast of Greece.
Just north of Crete. It's part of the Minoan civilization and so on. And my paternal grandfather left there in 1902 and went to Ellis Island.
Wow.
When you look at these islands, they look great, they're beautiful, romantic, and everything else. The soil is terrible and there's not enough water and you barely survive.
Okay.
And if you have a weak immune system, you die.
Oh, boy.
So islanders tend to live to quite a good age. And so in this nursing home, old people's home, there were 60 people with an average age of 89.
Wow.
And only one of them had any sign of macular degeneration.
Wow.
And this guy,
average age.
Yeah. Wow. And this guy had been wealthy and could afford to smoke. The rest of them had been poor, grew up on mostly a vegetable diet, a bean, heavily loaded, a bean-based diet, and olive oil, the Mediterranean diet.
Greek olive oil, absolutely.
Yeah, so this is now in 2000. AREDS had just come out or was in the process of coming out. And I looked at the literature, and Alan Bird from Moorfields had found the same thing in Sicily. Sicilians didn't get macular degeneration, so the Mediterranean diet protects your heart, blood vessels, and macula.
Wow.
So I came back and I tried the stats weren't quite right and we didn't publish it. But instead of that, we wrote a cookbook about eye health.
Feast Your Eyes, the book.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, a bit corny and so on. And it was an amateur production, but we sold 4,000 copies of that book and we made enough money to fund a research position. Now, and how I taught myself nutrition, you go through medical school and, they don't teach you much about diet. And so
they teach you zero.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I taught myself nutrition. I wrote the didactic part, and it's all about the fact that these diets like the Mediterranean diet are anti-inflammatory and they have a whole lot of benefits. And, of course, people focus on the heart and brain and so on, and they inconveniently forgot about the eye. And so it happens that it's good for eye health. So I wrote this. I ran it past a colleague who's an endocrinologist, and I hadn't made any major blunders in terms of the dietary side of it. And then one of my staff had been in the restaurant business and we found 40 leading chefs to contribute one recipe.
Oh, nice.
So then I became friends with some of them. And of course, now I'm overweight from dining out in all of these really great establishments. And, the book kind of went international in that some US colleagues bought it. The Transcend people gave it out for Christmas one year, and so there were a whole bunch of these books floating around. And then the problem is, to do a second edition, I'd have to take a year off, and I don't have time. But I'm almost finished writing a book on bean recipes. Okay. Because if you look around the world, the so-called blue zones, there are seven or so places in the world where people live a long time. And if you look at their diets, the only thing they all have in common is they eat beans. Mm. Now, beans are and not the same beans. They're not all baked beans or whatever. They're different varieties in different places. If you come from Okinawa, it's different to, say, the island of Ikaria, which is one of the blue zones, and Sardinia and El Salvador and so on. They're all different. There's even a colony of Seventh-day Adventists outside of Los Angeles at Loma Linda.
Yeah, Loma Linda. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So what I've done is I've done the didactic part of that, and now I'm going around the seven blue zones, finding chefs who will contribute one blue zone recipe for this new book. So that was what I did last Christmas.
So if you were going to give some advice to our Ophthalmology Business Podcast,
yep.
Give us a few good pearls regarding the Feast Your Eyes cookbook, or what's important in diet. What is it about the Mediterranean diet protected for the eyes? Give us a few pearls.
Yeah, okay. So the first thing, when you go through medical school, no one tells you to look after yourself.
Right.
They don't care. They don't care if you stay up all night studying and the rest of it, and you don't sleep adequately. They don't give.
It's true. It's absolutely true.
Yeah, first thing, look after yourself.
Okay.
Second thing is, don't use your profession as an excuse for not keeping fit.
Mm.
16, I was as good as the state champion in bike racing, racing bike. So I had a racing bike, I had 10 gears, I had all this stuff. And so I moved to Sydney, went to school here. I kept fit. I used to run at night and so on. By the time I'd got through ophthalmology, you know, I'd go to work all day, come home, eat too much and fall asleep. Put on weight, and then I started having some back problems, an L4-5 disc issue. And it was like a warning sign.
Mm.
So you're only as good as your back and neck in ophthalmology. And all the people go on about this, and there are special courses and things you can do. Do not stop exercising. Humans were made not to sit on a desk. They were made to roam the planet.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I don't go to a gym. I walk three nights a week for about 45 minutes, and it's as much as I can manage. I don't want to have huge muscles and the rest of it. And my view of gyms, it's a bit like that movie where the slaves are chained to an oar in the galley boats. And, you know, the whole thing is got to be fun, and walking gives me time to think and so on and so forth. So stay fit. From a dietary perspective, I mean – it's a very famous American nutritionist who, in fact, invented the Mediterranean diet. He went to Europe after the war. The Rockefeller Foundation paid him to go to Crete to study the diet of the people of Crete because they had survived the war on wild green vegetables and olive oil.
Ah.
At the time, people were dying in America in their 40s and 50s from heart disease.
Right.
And he thought that it was cholesterol. He became known as Dr. Cholesterol. He was on the front page of Time magazine and so on. But what he missed back then, he didn't understand about essential fatty acids and the ones that are pro-inflammatory and the ones that are not. So omega-3s, and you see now omega-3 is put in everything. It's in your bread and so on and so forth. One of the problems is humans now congregate in cities because cities make economic sense. If you have a big city, there's a problem. You have to feed it. How right. do you feed it? How do you feed it? You have to have food with long shelf life. Food with long shelf life contains things that are bad for your body.
Mm.
Pro-inflammatory things. So the things that are good for you, often perishable, like fish.
Mm.
And they cost more and everything else and so on. And so, but you can get around that with a vegetable-based diet lots of beans and those sorts of things. And then, of course, you inherit your genes from your family. You also inherit your eating habits.
Yeah.
And both are difficult to change.
Right. Yeah.
So I was lucky in that I grew up with a Mediterranean diet. In fact, I was the kid at school with the funny lunchbox. What's that?
All right.
And so, yeah, so pearls of advice, look after yourself. Don't get so busy you don't exercise. Look carefully at what you eat, and try and modify your diet in such a way that you don't have the sort of stuff that's there for shelf life, the pro-inflammatory essential fatty acids. In the American diet, omega-3 to omega-6 should be 2 to 1, I think. I need to check. But in fact, the American diet, it's like 50 to 1 of the bad stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So, and of course, it's convenient. Everyone's in a hurry. You've got stuff in the fridge. You know, you don't want it to perish and so on. And you do what is convenient rather than what is necessarily good for you.
You pay the price later.
Yeah, yeah. And these are things like, you know, it's like investment. 50 years later, you've got clagged coronary arteries and you know, the rest of it. The other thing, too, is that there's been a revision of lipids and cholesterol and so on. And the one thing that is missed frequently is lipoprotein little a.
It's
an independent risk factor. And there are still cardiologists that don't check it and so on and so forth. It's levels of education and intelligence and so on. So I know quite a lot of about lipoprotein little a for reasons that should be obvious. and there are treatments for it. And right. So it can be very effectively lowered initially by diet, but then the new drugs are just fabulous at getting these things under control. And so, you know, we live in an age where, you know, you can work. And also, I mean, my parents' generation, people died at a younger age than we are currently. I have 200 patients in my practice who are over the age of 90.
Wow, that's a lot.
I was thinking of having a street party for them. Because, and many of them are still functioning, I mean, really well. So the notion that you could work to 65 or 70 and retire and so on is passé. Really, I mean, you go for as long as your body and brain still works. And, I mean, of course, I found ophthalmology to be a fabulous. I get up every morning and I'm an eye doctor and I'm excited about it.
Yes, you and me both. I think that's very common. I am... Every day, I am thankful to be an ophthalmologist. How did I get so lucky?
Yeah, indeed. And so, you know, I think that also helps because a bunch of people are unhappy with their line of work and all of the rest of it. And if you're not excited about ophthalmology, become so.
Right. You know,
it's not that difficult to do.
That's one thing you're really amazing at is relentless intellectual curiosity within so many aspects of ophthalmology. You've done very well.
Well, I was the firstborn son in a migrant family. The expectations were high.
Yeah, I can relate, you and me both.
Yeah, okay.
Different countries, same concept.
And my father used to say that knowledge is power.
Yeah.
He also said that big business deals were done on golf courses, so of course I can play golf. I tried to know, before there were computers, I tried deliberately to know more than anyone else. Now, there are a lot of bright people, and when I moved to Sydney, I'm at this selective boys' high school with a whole bunch of rocket science smart kids.
Sure.
And so on. But the more I did this, the more fun it became. And it wasn't just knowing facts. It was the ability to link them.
The next step, the next level.
Yeah, and somehow or other, I think at university, I realized when I was in a research laboratory, I realized that I can actually do this. And nice. And with time and the challenges, I got better at it. And then as I point one earlier on was about being challenged. I mean, you can challenge your students to find a solution or to do more. But then career-wise, in academia, you get challenged quite a lot. You even get threatened.
That's very common in academia.
Yeah, yeah. And Henry Kissinger used to say that these academic fights were so vicious because there was so little at stake.
I left academia a few years ago. I'm very happy I did so.
Yeah, no, well, I'm happy I didn't, because I'm still meeting people who are really, really fascinating. One of my best friends at our hospital is a psychiatrist. And okay. We started talking, and he's very smart, and we started talking about how in his expertise is depression and how depressed people have these sort of their eye appearance. So we actually wrote a paper about it. So here I am interacting with people. And one of the nice things about a big teaching hospital is you can interact with people in other specialties and you learn from them. And you see, Duke Elder passed away a long time ago. And if you come to my office, I have the 15 or so volumes of his. And I was actually thinking of resurrecting it, because what I'd like to do is a review of ophthalmology in all of the other medical specialties. Cardiology and so on. Someone will now rush off and do it, but I wish them luck. But it's kind of like a retirement project that you then link your specialty back to all of the others. And I don't know if you knew Ivan Schwab from Davis. He was a friend.
From UC Davis in Sacramento, California.
I used to go to the American Academy, and Ivan would give these talks on bird eyes. And like there'd be two people in the audience, and because of that, I got to know him a little. And he was a great intellect, lovely man, and
brilliant man.
Yeah, and so he came up with the idea, that the neurologist will tell you that the eye is an outgrowth of the brain.
Okay.
But in fact, the reverse is true. When life evolved in the sea, these molecules developed that could sense light, and you could turn light into energy. So the most valuable resource we have is light as a source of energy, information, and so on. So the eye evolved over about 500 million years into something like a fisheye, and the brain developed mostly to process visual information. And the other sensory systems are all based around the visual system. So this is an ophthalmologist's view of the brain. And then the function of the rest of the body is to take the eye somewhere where it can be useful.
That's too funny.
So this is, you can see how I challenge my colleagues in other specialties, and particularly neurology, around this sort of concept that basically it's all about the eye and everything else can go to hell. But,
I went to a big party recently with a lot of MDs, a lot of physicians, two ophthalmologists, me and a friend of mine who's a retina colleague. All the primary care doctors think that ophthalmologists are crazy. They said, how do you spend your whole life specializing in something the size of a walnut? Yeah. And then to that, my retina colleague replied, no. I only care about a few cell layers, about 300 microns worth.
Yeah.
They thought we were extra crazy.
Yeah. No, but there, and the other problem, of course, as I said earlier, ophthalmology isn't well taught to the rest of our colleagues. I mean, really, right. We're a small part of the medical faculty, we're under threat from optometry and all these other things going on. But I mean, and to come back to this whole business about evolution of the eye, most people don't realize the evolution of the eye gave Darwin cold shudders. It kept him awake at night, because how could something so perfect? He called it the organ of extreme perfection.
Right.
How could it evolve? Surely God had to have made it. And so the eye was right in the middle of the whole debate about evolution and creation, going way back. And it turns out Darwin was very good friends with Bowman.
Okay.
And there's correspondence between the two of them. And Bowman lent Darwin a book about eye disease. So he was
Bowman's layer of the cornea.
Yeah, that Bowman. Sir William Bowman. These are Brits, they're intellectuals, they'd sit around, but they interacted. And so Darwin was actually aware of ophthalmology and ophthalmic diseases. He actually made a comment about how the hell anyone could still see given the dreadful diseases that afflict the eye. Guess what I'm getting into here is partly, I've had a bit of fun looking at the history of ophthalmology. We published a paper on Leeuwenhoek, who had the first proper microscopy and could see microorganisms and so on. It's in Survey of Ophthalmology. And he was a draper. Okay. And drapers had 20 diopter lenses to look at fabric. Okay. And then he started looking at living organisms. And one of the first things he did is that he looked at the eye. Well, because he wanted to know how it could see so well. So the earliest description of the cornea and the retina and so on were by this draper. And because he wasn't a scientist, it wasn't in the medical literature. So we summarized all of this. I don't have images. I wanted to find the first drawing of the cornea. There is one of lens and so on. So all of this stuff, when you dig a little bit, and this is my research training, because my first research mentor said, there's very little that's new under the sun. A lot of this stuff has been published before. Most of it is in the German literature. So you need to know some German and you need to know the history of your specialty. Otherwise, you just go and reinvent something that was already there and someone will eventually point this out to you. So again, I've had that sort of dimension to my thinking about a whole lot of these things. And I mean, I see you published a paper on triamcinolone to look at aqueous currents. Post-operatively. Yeah. So, I mean, I've just had a paper accepted with Steve Safran on reverse pupil block and how particles circulate in the eye. Sure. And he, very keen observer, and saw, so if you have a vitrectomized pseudophakic eye, you often, and particularly myopic eyes, you often get reverse pupil block. The reason this happens is because about 50% of aqueous humor is pumped out of the retina through the retinal pigment epithelium. Now, that's been known for decades, but conveniently ignored. The conventional wisdom is that it all goes through the pupil into the anterior chamber, circulates, and goes out through the canal of Schlemm. Now, the function of the lens iris sort of diaphragm is like it kind of burps fluid into the anterior chamber, but a big chunk of the aqueous is being pumped out through the retinal pigment epithelium. When you die, your retina falls off because that mechanism stops. There's no pumping. It's like a hydraulic thing going on. So Steve was one of the first to see that in these eyes, because he does a whole lot of Yamani procedures and complicated cases, that he could see clinical evidence of this posterior flow of aqueous humor. Now, that paper got rejected like about three or four times and so on and so forth. We finally had a sort of an acceptance of it. I have to rewrite bits of it. But, so this is – and I've really enjoyed my interactions with really, really high-end clinicians and surgeons who are really observant. And then I try and fill in the gaps on the science front. And it's been a very productive time to do this sort of stuff.
It's been an amazing time. Things have changed so much in the last decade or so. Now, We've been talking for more than an hour. I can't believe if you're going to give, let's end it something very simple. A lot of young ophthalmologists love this podcast. So if you have a young ophthalmologist, a young registrar or resident or fellow or new graduate, what's the best advice you can give them to have a great, fruitful career? Stay curious, probably.
So much of this happens by accident. I would say beyond your basic training, and you don't have much choice of that, is to pick a good mentor.
Right.
Now, you don't want someone who's about to retire. You want someone who's about mid-career in good health, who can help you beyond the year or so that you spend with them.
Yeah.
And that's good for both sides, because I get great ideas from my trainees. I mean, they're smart, they're keen, they challenge you and so on. And so this kind of the trick for me is to stay ahead of them, if you can, and this is the intellectual side of it. And when the day comes when I can't, it might be time to sort of hang up. But I think if I could give any advice, it's not necessarily the name of the institution and the volume of surgery that you do and so on. All of that can be fixed. What can't be fixed is the intellectual side of it.
Right.
You need good direction and someone who thinks about what they're doing, and obviously they need to be, in a good position to be able to do this. And sometimes these people are not in obvious places. So, if I had to give one piece of advice, and my mentors were a professor of physiology, a professor of ophthalmology, a professor of renal medicine, and a professor in Berlin who had studied renal medicine and then did ophthalmology later in life, Michael Wiederholt. Now, he ran an ocular physiology lab in Klinikum Steglitz back in 1989. I was there the year the wall came down.
Wow.
And he was a big influence on me. I mean, I came back and I tried to set up a basic sciences laboratory, and for various reasons, it didn't happen. And to some extent, I'm not that ungrateful about it, because it meant I don't have a big research empire. I don't have to. One of my colleagues has a staff of 500. He runs the Neuroscience Institute in my hospital.
Okay.
He's a clinician scientist, and he's now an administrator. Whereas I can come home on the weekend and set up a perfusion model of the anterior chamber in my kitchen with a fish tank pump and so on and so forth. And
if you look at like my, that, I like that better.
Yeah. Well, for me, it's been a lot more fun. And I haven't published as much as a lot of people, because the drudgery of putting together a review with 500 references and so on, I mean, it's really hard work. And keeping all of this in your head while you're looking after patients and everything else is, but now with AI, I've become much more efficient than that. And because I'm not saddled with a huge empire, I'm actually more efficient than I've ever been. And it's fun. It means that I can go from, I'm currently writing three major reviews. Wow. And I can flip between them without that much effort and stay focused enough that they will get finished in the next month or so. And so that part of it. So I hope I've answered your question. We've been around the countryside.
it's fantastic advice. But I think ultimately for every young ophthalmologist, find your own direction, find your own self. You don't have to be Minas. You don't have to be Uday. You can be you and do what makes sense for you.
Yeah. Find something that you find interesting and pursue it. And this is the other bit, the discipline. So discipline is no longer fashionable.
Yeah.
In modern society, I mean, and this is a little bit political, but whether you believe in God or not, Western societies grew up with Christianity and the Ten Commandments and the Seven Deadly Sins. Now, the left side of politics in particular have turned many of the Seven Deadly Sins into virtues. particularly sloth and envy.
Yeah.
So to come back to the advice, find something that really interests you and stick to it, and develop it, and think, where will this take me in 10 years? And if the answer is nowhere, then find something where you can pursue it for the next 10 years, because you're going to have to live with yourself with the knowledge you have for the rest of your career.
That's great. Actually great advice.
And the more interesting you make it, I mean, my wife and I have this tactic of when the politics all got very difficult, we saw it as entertainment value. So it was actually better than watching television. And what that does is that it removes most of the stress.
Yeah.
You can pretty much say, we know what they're going to do next.
I have it even easier. I just ignore and take no part in any politics. I don't have any bandwidth to waste on that nonsense. Let me focus my whatever bandwidth I have on things I actually enjoy.
Sure. But I had a different plan of trying to build something in an institution. My department, the previous head had been there. My department was created in the early 1900s. It was part of an infectious diseases hospital in Sydney. And I got interested in COVID as well. this is another thing. One of the pathways for how COVID gets into the body is through the surface of the eye.
Okay.
I don't know if you've read the paper that we published on this, but so in 1919, the Spanish flu killed more American service people than bullets.
Okay.
There was an American epidemiologist who discovered the fact that, you know, if you put a marker bacterium in the tear film, you can locate it in the nasopharynx. Within 30 seconds, you know, put an eye drop in your eye. So now you're walking through a room. Coronavirus can float in the air for many hours at a time. It is the tips on the spikes are positively charged. The surface of your tear film is negatively charged. So this thing leaps through the air, ends up in your tear film. 30 seconds later, it's in your nasopharynx.
Done.
Where it breathes, and it spreads south into the lungs and into the gut. Now, because it's in the lungs, the respiratory people tell everyone you breathe it in. Now, the nose isn't such a stupid structure. The nose has hairs and mucus and stuff, it traps a lot of these things, but you don't, so unless you have eye protection. So this is quite controversial. And what did we learn from COVID? The answer wasn't all that much, because we still don't advocate for eye protection.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not just coronavirus, it's adenoviruses and influenza. So ophthalmologists get more adenovirus than anyone else, and we spread it. You know, the famous sort of...
In our clinics. Yeah, you for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Everyone thinks it's because it's dirty and you haven't cleaned your tonometer tips and your hands and so on.
It's in the air.
Yeah. And we don't know whether or not ophthalmologists get more influenza, but possibly we do because of the same pathway. So I'm actually working on a review article with someone from CDC on this ocular pathway for coronavirus. And the second part of this, which never took off, is that it might be possible to treat the initial infection with eye drops that get into the nasopharynx and kill the virus there before it comes. Yeah, so I wrote a patent around that and it didn't go anywhere. But because, you know, there was a whole controversy around hydroxychloroquine with your president going on about it and so on. And the mistake they made was that they tested a lot of these drugs in cultured cells, and the receptors for the virus are on the apex of the cell, and then there are tight junctions and then the basolateral aspect. So if you apply it topically, it works, but if you give it systemically, it doesn't go to the apex of the cell. So they don't know one end of a cell from another. So during COVID, I had made up hydroxychloroquine eye drops that my staff and I used when we went to work in the morning. Now, we know the dosage because it was used in, has been used in India to treat dry eye as an anti-inflammatory drug. And so none of us got infected. Now, it could be that we were careful with all sorts of other things, but this idea of treating viruses in the nasopharynx via the ocular pathway never really took off. So I haven't given up on it, but it's another one of these projects that's been rumbling along in the
back. The mind is always thinking, you're always thinking, what is next? Your intellectual curiosity has got to be top 0.1% among ophthalmologists. I love it.
Well, it's who I've become, I'm afraid.
it's in your DNA. You can't change that.
Anyway,
that's amazing. I mean, this podcast has been so informative for me. I've like thought about so many things. I should do this. I should do this. I should do the other. Wow, what a great time talking. I want to thank you again for spending the last hour plus just chit-chatting here.
Oh, my absolute pleasure, Dave. And I hope that came up to expectations. And congratulations on what you do. I mean, I think it's important to keep people informed, and you're much better at this than I am, which is great, and hopefully we can interact a bit more.
Absolutely. Well, again, we all have slightly different roles, and we just kind of embrace the roles that you know resonate with us. For you, that's incredible intellectual curiosity, 60 patents, everything else. For me, it's like I like making videos.
Well, I could have been in the movie business, but I didn't kind of quite get there, I'm afraid. But all good.
Fantastic. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new CataCoach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find a podcast, you find the CataCoach podcast. And of course, we got a new CataCoach video every single day, 3,000 days in a row and counting. Of course, there's a new CataCoach video tomorrow. So until next time, I'll catch you later.